Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I often get books in the mail, which is a good thing. You know, publishers and sometimes authors will send me their latest work. And as you can imagine, some are good and some are not so good. But even in those that appeal to me, I always need to find what I call a hook, some topic we can talk about that kind of is prompted by the subject of the book for about half an hour or so. But recently I got a book that was different. The book is called Lunch Bucket Paradise, a True Life Novel. The author is Fred Setterberg, and he's joining us here from California. Welcome, Fred.
Hi, Court. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you on. So I would, you know, having read the book, I'd call it really more a memoir than a novel. I told Fred it's a little hard for me to see the hook in it, but there are certainly things we can talk about that are going to be interesting. And the book is extremely well-written and interesting and engaging, you know, which is why I really wanted to do it. It's about the life and times of a young boy growing up in suburban California from, I guess, about 1950 through about 1969, so roughly a 20-year span there that really was, the heart of the 20th century and covered so much change in our culture, right? And the book is really a clear window on that world, the childhood of the baby boomers, really, I would say, growing up in the post-World War II boom times when America was on top of the world, right? And we had the world by the throat and by the tail, I suppose. And for the first time, working class people could afford to buy a modest home in the suburbs and have a car and a TV and a small lawn that they tended to a perfect level of greenness and floweriness and putter around with hobbies on the weekend. So really, we're talking about the flowering of the American dream. So I told Fred that it reminds me of J.D. Salinger, if you've read, as everybody who graduated from high school, I guess, has read Catcher in the Rye. And it's kind of a nostalgia for the innocence of childhood, right? And Fred, the main character seems to me like it must be autobiographical. It must be you, is it?
Well, it is in a large sense. Of course, you were saying that it reads a lot like a memoir, and I have to agree with you. We have a first-person, unnamed narrator, you know, the I of the book, who's telling the story of his family and growing up and the small world of his suburb, which is his entire world. And between the chapters, I have period photographs. So we see the early suburbs being built. We see folks in their working clothes outside, kids in a band with silver sparkly jackets playing James Brown tunes. You know, things that you couldn't quite recreate today. But it's not really a memoir. I knew that I wanted to write about my upbringing for a long time. I wanted to write about blue-collar suburbs that I just never found in fiction or saw most of the time in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write about a place that was new. As you were saying, it's the pioneer days of the suburbs before the suburbs become the dominant way of life in America as they are today. I mean, I remember in this neighborhood as a child, I would climb up the back of our redwood fence in the backyard, and then on the other side there was a farm. And at one side of one end of our street, there was another farm, and at the other end, another farm. And the suburbs were the new thing; they were the little spawn that was going to grow over coming decades, until all those edges of town were linked together in one huge concrete lawn.
Mm.
And I wanted the perspective of that moment when it first begins.
Well, you're right. You know, when you think about it, there's not much written about that. Really, kind of boring suburban life of the 50s and 60s, but basically everybody lived it. Nearly everybody I knew did. I mean, I grew up in Miami, and we were in the west part of Miami, and it was a spit of sand that had been shoved out into the Everglades, and they called it West Miami, and had a big hurricane fence around it to keep the alligators out and the kids in, I guess. But I think a high percentage of people in the country lived that way. So what do you think caused that cultural shift, like in California and across the nation, that brought us suburbs all of a sudden out of nowhere?
Right. Well, I think you're so right that it was a almost universal experience. And we owe that moment of wealth that you were describing a few moments ago, we owe it all to World War II. You know, that the United States stepping into the world stage. We were attacked only in Hawaii, while the rest of Europe and large parts of Asia were completely ravaged.
Mm-hmm.
And then we spend the next 40 years being the bankers and the construction crew for rebuilding the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things you miss when you were a kid in those suburbs was, of course, it's the only thing you know, so you don't have your parents' perspective, you know, my folks and the people I grew up around, which was their dominant experience. What formed them was first the Depression, right? Losing everything. My dad's family lost their land in Oregon. Before that, they had been farmers in Canada, and they had lost their property there.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a dominant theme, you know, people just hanging on by their fingernails. And then come the 50s. I mean, we had a recession after the war, but once the 50s begin and we've moved all the industrial capacity of war making into building cars and homes and, you know, these, frankly, luxury items that didn't exist before. And it's a brand new world. And I know in the family I write about in this book, which is certainly the spirit of my family, there's a combined sense of giddiness about these new riches, you know, relative riches for working people. Like you say, the ability to buy a house, a small house, the kind of house they don't build anymore, 1,100 square feet. But it's combined with a sense that things can go bad at any point. You know, our life experience tells us, if you were born in 1918, early 20s, our experience tells us that the bottom can drop out.
Mm-hmm.
And you can suddenly find yourselves in 10 years of financial disaster, and then you can enter into the most horrific conflict the world had ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
So we may be sitting fat and happy at the moment, but we're looking over our shoulders. And that's one of the things I tried to get across in this book, was the sense of foreboding that people also had while they were celebrating their new riches. It's only accidental that I actually finished this book around 2008.
Hmm.
And just as the bottom dropped out once again, you know, the sort of thing that I think not a lot of people expected to see happen twice in 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not as severe, of course, but the sense that everything is possible and everything will only get better, that's a hard proposition to endorse right now, given the experience of the last 4 years. And I think that sensibility kind of runs through my book. You know, I mean, it's a book that I have really strived to make true as I could, to try to convey the experience of ordinary people who I think don't show up so often in literature, but whose lives are just as psychologically complex as anybody else's.
Sure.
And I also wanted to make it funny, because I think it's a time of great contradiction. I mean, I think of these suburbs as in their pioneer years. You know, that folks are out there building the red brick fireplace and planting the azaleas and the new rose bushes. And rather than our picture of, you know, carbon copy houses, you know, all stamped from the same mold, I mean, that may have been true physically in the design of many suburbs, but my recollection is that the men and women who bought these houses then got out and did everything they could to make them their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to put that little bit of craft and desire and affection for a particular plant, mm-hmm. to make that our castle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the thing that we own, and it's ours, and it's deeply close to our heart.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Fred Setterberg about his book, Lunch Bucket Paradise, a true life novel, but really more about the whole ambiance and environment that it describes, which is early suburban America in the 50s and in the early to mid-60s. You know, and I would say, Fred, you were talking about, you know, you try to make the book funny and so on, and that people personalize their own little postage stamp that they own within the suburb, but you know, it's usually the past, when we look at it from a distance, is idealized. You know, we make it either horrific or wonderful, you know, one extreme or the other. But life in those suburbs, as it is today, it wasn't all Beaver Cleaver and Ozzie and Harriet, which we tend to idealize it as. And so in your community, which is called Jefferson Manor, there's a, you know, good amount of racism and bullying and what was then called juvenile delinquency and you know, conflict between husbands and wives, and the same kind of stuff that goes on today, although maybe not as explosively or as intensely or whatever. But why don't you describe a little bit of that, the dark side to paradise there in the suburbs in California?
Yeah, I think what you say is really important. And the fact that underneath the foundation of these early 50 suburbs is the experience of war in the Pacific and in Europe, that's an important factor. I'm not sure that kids today grow up playing war like you and I probably did,
mm-hmm.
where it was the default play game for boys out on their front lawn. And part of it was just the mythos of the families we grew up in, where the men had spent maybe 4 years in the Pacific. You know, some of my uncles spent 4 years there, and that was with them for the rest of their lives. And it would kind of leak out. You know, it almost never was addressed directly, but it would wander into a conversation.
Mm.
And the sense of, you know, the very real violence of recent history would then be reenacted again and again in games as children, but also in just a kind of roughness about life, in a way that I don't really think it's true for middle-class kids today. God knows there's far too much violence in our culture as it is, and particularly with a lot of young people, but there was a kind of acceptable and expected kind of, you got to battle your way through things, and you have to learn to sort of stand up on your own and take care of bullies. And in the shadow of that, I can't help feeling that for a lot of parents, they may not say this explicitly, but that bully was Adolf Hitler, you know, that punk kid down the street who keeps harassing all the other little kids. You got to stand up to him because we know what happens when you don't. But then we know what happens when you do, too. You know, we know the terrible price that is paid. I think, you know, when you're a kid, right, you think back in your childhood, and that bully from around the block, he assumes a kind of monstrous shape, right? You remember him as being 12 feet tall with muscles of steel, and how could anybody ever just stand up to him? And that's the experience of being a little kid. And I wanted to get some of that into this book. You know, that kind of really visceral, in-your-guts fear about turning the corner into a neighborhood that you didn't know quite as well. Or when you're 10 or 11 and suddenly there's the introduction of the terrifying teenagers, you know, who would smoke and drink and, you know, do things that you couldn't defend yourself against.
Mm-hmm.
I want a sense of, even in the peaceable kingdom of the suburbs, there's a kind of reversion to the jungle at any moment. It's just what it is to be human. And the notion of the beaver cleaver life, right, well, that only exists on TV. So there's no place in America where you ever would find that.
Hmm.
But Jefferson Manor is not the suburbs of John Cheever short stories. It's a different place where people come from rougher backgrounds. Nobody's been to college.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows anybody who's been to college. But because of the economic miracle, and I have to say, out here in California, because of the wisdom and generosity of the taxpayers, all those kids of plumbers and laborers and factory workers in the 1960s, we had basically a free ride through an excellent state university system,
mm-hmm.
and our lives were transformed. I mean, in some ways, I think this is the amazing accomplishment of this part of the culture, this moment, is that people who could only barely glimpse what the world of higher education was and what it would mean. They did all the work that allowed their kids, and more importantly, people who weren't their kids, the neighbor kids, people whose faces they would never see, allowed them to step into the world and then, you know, in my state, help build Silicon Valley and the aerospace industry and the entertainment industry and so many things that have been transformative for the world. But it was on the backs of those folks who did that hard work for decades and decades and then had that little moment, you were saying, that 20-year interregnum between crises.
Hmm.
And then, you know, we hit the mid-70s and wages are flat and they never get rising again, at least they haven't today.
You know, so much of what you're saying is so familiar to me. I mean, my father, as a teenager, was a carpenter. His father was a construction superintendent. And worked on big projects in Palm Beach, you know, some of the big mansions out on the ocean, that kind of thing, and was well-to-do, you know, owned properties and a drugstore and rental houses and that kind of thing. But the Depression came along and knocked him flat. My grandfather on my mother's side, similar thing. And, you know, so they ended up almost broke. But my father expected to be a carpenter. But the big thing about World War II, or one of them in the post-World War II era, was the GI Bill, which basically allowed all veterans to go to college for free, and it broke everybody out of the cycle of being either rural or working class, and those who didn't take advantage of that. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is those who went to college, like my dad, and became an engineer during the 50s, late 40s and early 50s, had been blue-collar and would have been blue-collar had they not chosen to take advantage of that. And so those who didn't take advantage of it still became middle class, really, and their kids then went to college, and so it was like a, you know, a half-generation stall, in a way, for them. But your narrator's father, whose name is Franklin, is a very central figure in the book. Was he an average suburban working-class guy? He was one of those who did not go to college, but he was self-educated, you know, so was he an average guy, or was he atypical?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways he was atypical, and the figure of Franklin is really very closely drawn from my dad. Named Franklin because, of course, FDR in our household was a semi-deity.
Hmm.
I don't remember a time as a child when I didn't know who Roosevelt was and his wife and their little dog. And so my father, I think, was, and Franklin in this book, he was like so many of the working guys in our town, but more so. He spends 3 years in a public TB hospital in San Francisco in the 30s, and expecting to die, he spends all of his time reading every book in the library. You know, he reads in that kind of undiscriminating, chaotic way of, you know, jumping from John Stuart Mill's to James Thurber, to reading the history of Utah and histories about every river in the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reading whatever falls in your hand and being hungry for knowledge. There's a scene in the book, which is also taken directly from life, where my narrator takes a photograph of his father, and it's a picture of him in the army working on an airplane in Hawaii, and turns it over and sees that he's written on the back a quote from a college professor in the East saying, "The sign of a cultivated person is his ability to walk with confidence in the wide open world." And of course, that's something that my narrator's father can't do. You know, he sees that world. He's got that little bit of knowledge that all the books he's read in his life, and that he keeps reading, he stands on top of them, and he sees out beyond the horizon. But he also knows that he can't quite go there. And for that, he's both embittered and wondrous at the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's that combination of things that I think drives him through. My own dad was a great reader, and he was a person who always introduced me to books until I got to be old enough to, you know, find something new and put it under his eyes. And then we could have a lifetime conversation about whatever it was. But I had urged him to go to college when he retired finally. He retired pretty young, about 60, and he worked for the Navy for about 3 decades. But it was just too foreign. You know, it's like, well, that's your world. You go. And that's the gift, right? That's at best what one generation can do for another, can kind of point in a direction and help you pack your bag and say, you go out there and tell me what it's like when you get back. That's really what I tried to do in this book, is try to give a report from what was ordinary life mid-century like for lots and lots of people, and try to pose some of the evasions and the misrepresentations too. You know, you had mentioned the unease, the kind of casual violence, the racism of the town. This is the town I'm describing is backed right up to the border of Oakland, which was, if not a majority, a large population of African Americans. And there might as well have been an armed guard at the border, because no black people during the 50s and 60s crossed in at all. And if you got in there, you were going to be harassed. And there was no way that a black family would ever buy a home in this area. And yeah, that's a hard thing to kind of look back and fit that all together with people you grew up with and loved and respected. And to know that just that aspect of American life at that point, you know, a deeply racist segregation of society was there out there in the West as well as in so many other places. And at the same time, the kids so deeply embracing black music, because it's the era of Motown. You know, it's Smokey Robinson and the Miracles.
Sure.
And, you know, it's James Brown and Wilson Pickett and all this great music that's now kind of middle America's dance music, right? You go to a New Year's party and someone's going to put on the Temptations as we kind of stagger along the dance floor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the great irony, you know, that the music of Motown, from Motor City, Berry Gordy and Motown Records, that was kind of the the background music to the civil rights movement and the black nationalist movement is now happy party music for the American middle class.
That's the way our culture goes, yeah. You take the challenging stuff and turn it into marketing. So, speaking of marketing, you are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Fred Sederberg, who's the author of Lunch Bucket Paradise, which is a novel, kind of a memoir, but also sort of a novel, about growing up in a suburb in California in the 50s and early 60s. Fred, the book covers, you know, again, those years, that 20-year period, and it ends really just as what I think of as the 60s really began to transform American culture. I think, you know, the 60s really started in about 66 and ended in about 73 or so. But right in that period, you know, there was this giant upheaval that the baby boom, as they came into their late teenage years and started to sort of get traction in our culture, sort of turned everything upside down in that semi-idyllic, at least on the exterior, conformist 50s world began to implode. So how big a change did communities like your fictional Jefferson Manor undergo during that 20-year span? I mean, was it kind of like Archie Bunker and All in the Family, or was it not that extreme? Or, you know, what was it like in where you were in California?
Well, I think it was pretty extreme and gradual, right? I mean, as you say, the 60s is the prolonged moment. It doesn't happen overnight. So in the community I'm writing about, this is the kind of town where a lot of the guys get drafted and end up in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because they're great proponents of the war or have a kind of ideological position or anything. It's because government calls and what do? You know, you're a kid, we'll go and have the adventure of my lifetime and see what we make of it. And an awful lot came back, and what they made of it wasn't very good. You know, they came back and they had a lot of disturbing stuff to report. And the sense that the country was on the right course was shaken. And
yeah,
some of those guys came back smoking dope, but some of the other, you know, kids in the neighborhood would then kind of venture out beyond the confines of the city, which is now grown, and it was linked up to bigger cities. And from Jefferson Manor, you could drive for an hour and be at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And if it's 1969, you might sit down and listen to the Grateful Dead play for free in the park, or the smell of marijuana was heavy as clouds.
Or drop acid.
That's right. That's right. And then come back home to your little suburb, and it can't quite be the same. And you think of that being multiplied, you know, hundreds of times in every town over thousands of little cities, and expectations start to shake. You know, the country's not going to go quite the same direction that you would have thought it was going to in 1957, and everything's called into question. And I think a key thing with that, then, is the expected continuing prosperity. 1969, things are still going pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time you hit mid-70s, you can feel we've got a big recession, and you can feel the brakes are starting to screech. And it's a little harder to get your kid in a union slot in the, you know, carpenters union. And it's a little harder to find that job of which there were, you know, 30 a few years before. And people start looking outward and inward and wondering, well, where are we going? You know, and it seems like that's the question that has been so prominent now for the last 30 or 40 years. You know, that sense of confidence that we're moving in the right direction and things will only get better and better. I don't think too many people would say that today. And I think it begins right where my book leaves off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think even the kids from places like Jefferson Manor who didn't go to Vietnam, and a lot of them went there because they didn't have a college deferment, right? But,
well,
you know,
absolutely.
When they came back, they were alienated from the counterculture hip society or hippie-like or flower child kind of, you know, ethos that had developed among the rest of their generation. And so the kids that didn't go to Vietnam got out of there. They didn't want to live in that little 1,100 square foot house and continue doing what their dad had done, being henpecked by the wife and escaping into the garage to work on his car. And it was too confining. And so I think the continuity of that culture in the suburbs basically shattered around that time pretty much nationwide.
Yeah, amazing how quickly it could happen, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of years, really. So, you know, let's get back to the working class thing. I mean, you describe it as a working class suburb, but it was kind of like the lines between white collar and blue collar sort of began to soften around that time because these people were really leading middle-class lives. They had the material stuff that somebody like my dad, who was an engineer, but who was also pretty poor, and with three kids in a row, you know, they were all pretty much in the same boat economically, and that boat was rising. The tide was rising, right? So people had more stuff. And so I think the working class really became the new middle class, and people in Detroit working on assembly lines were suddenly making, you know, a lot. In today's terms, they were making $60,000, $70,000 a year, a lot more than they're making today. And they had jobs, which they don't have today. But, I mean, you talk about physical labor as a theme in your book. I think it's portrayed in both positive and negative ways.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I think one of the great blessings of growing up at that time is that you did get to learn what hard work was, how grueling it could be to be, you know, digging holes all day, or, you know, unloading a boxcar, doing stuff that makes your back hurt and that might end up in you being injured during the day. And then you end up not having to do it your entire life. If you were a kid who then went to college and gets a ticket out of the laboring class, you can leave with respect for what that means and a sigh of relief that you're not going to have to try to pull your aging body through that work your whole life. But I know in this town that I'm writing about, labor is respected and feared. Respected in the sense that everybody does something that requires a body in motion.
We just have a minute or so left. You said earlier that you really had finally decided to revisit your childhood, and that's why you wanted to write this book. But just briefly, did it lead you to any new understanding of your life or of things in general?
Yeah, I think it really did. The long process of writing this book over several years really allowed me to understand the possibilities that my parents and the people who surrounded us felt when they really began their pioneer years in the suburbs. That sense of possibility and those possibilities that they wanted to send along to their children, to me and my generation. It made me feel enormous gratitude for their sacrifice and their steadiness. And I have to say their vision. You know, no one knew how it would turn out, but a lot of people put an awful lot of work into trying to make a better country, and a sense that we are in things together, that we have a collective fate. And that's one of the things that became much clearer to me in reimagining that life that I had led as a kid.
I think it was really the peak time of our culture. Tom Brokaw described that generation as the greatest generation. And, you know, again, it glosses over a lot of things. But on balance, I think they probably were. I'll tell you, we can talk for a lot longer about this time in American history. And we can talk with Fred, who's very interesting about his book and his experience. But you can go to www.fredsetterberg.com. I'll spell it Fred, the normal spelling, and then SETTERBERG.com, fredsetterberg.com. He also is on Facebook, Facebook.com/Fred.Setterberg, and has written other books that you might want to look at. But this particular one we're talking about is Lunch Bucket Paradise. Fred, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you, Court. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.